Did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? And they found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to create gummies, baked goods, and flower for whatever type of buzz you'd want. I'm talking about Mood.com. They have an incredible line of cannabis gummies, and you get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. This isn't some rinky-dink discount of 5 or 10%. This is 20% off your first order. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. My favorite are the Sleepy Time Advanced gummies. That's right, those are for sleepy time. You know when you just can't fall asleep? Take these and they'll put you right in the mood. Beyond gummies, Mood also has a selection of flower, pre-rolls, bakery treats, and beverages. Listen, you can find gummies to just get you high pretty much everywhere these days. But Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get into the perfect mood, usually in as little as 15 minutes. And everything ships discreetly right to your door. No dispensary lines, no awkward conversations, just better days and nights delivered to your doorstep. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. So head to Mood.com, find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code SPECIALISTS when you check out to save 20% on your first order. Try it today at mood.com.
Survivor Specialist John and McKenna are back, and we are so excited to rewind episode 3 of Survivor 46. John, I liked this episode. It was a little bit, you know, long, and it had some camp life aspects, but it gave us some fun things to talk about for our rewind. It might not have been as entertaining for, like, Phil or Blake to recap, but for the rewind, it has some great moments to call back on.
I agree. I did enjoy this episode. I think I'm a little higher on Banu than most of the Survivor fandom at this point. but I really enjoy him as a character. Like, even like watching his arc so far over these first three episodes has been very entertaining. And I'm really looking forward to seeing where he ends up going in the end. But this episode did some weird things with, like, edits and stuff. Obviously, we have to jump back to 4 days prior, which was a little weird when it comes to Survivor. Kind of shows that, like, you know, when a season's not planned for 90 minutes, they aren't quite prepared for it. But in the end, I quite enjoyed it. I think it's setting up for some interesting things to happen down the road, especially with Bonnie, like, spilling the beans about the entire tribe dynamic. To who was that? That was Ben and Liz. So I'm interested to see how this progresses. But more importantly, we have some really interesting things to talk about this episode because of it.
Yeah. So before we get into all that, Juan makes a comment. Why is Natalie White on the cover? So just in case you did not hear our first episode of The Rewind, we are breaking things down into outwit moments, outplay moments, and outlast moments. So our cover with Natalie White, Russell Swan, and Banu deals with one of our outwit, outplay, or outlast moments. And stick around to find out. Make sure you like and subscribe. Hit the bell for notifications, because you're going to want to try and speculate what our rewind covers mean.
Yeah, it's true. Our thumbnails, Austin Garso is killing it with them. And we like putting a little bit of mystery into what we're going to talk about. So hopefully when you see random survivors on them, you can connect those dots to how we might be thinking about the episodes.
Last week, two Philip Shepherds, very confusing, but it's because we talked about two different Philip Shepherd moments from two different seasons, so we wanted those represented. But let's get into our outwit moments for this episode of 46. We wanted to talk about, like, threat hunting in the pre-merge of your allies. So there have been times where, you know, survivors vote people off because they're going to be a threat in the merge, but they're not exactly aligned. They're just like, well, they're on the other side and they're going to be a threat, so let's get them out. But we wanted to focus on turning on an alliance member and getting them out because they might be a threat later on, or just you don't want them around in camp.
Yeah, and this is actually something that's a little harder to pinpoint in Survivor history, because a lot of the times we see people who are on the same original tribe, they get swapped, and then they have to kind of turn on each other, and they have like a pseudo alliance of convenience at that point, but they aren't lockstep really. And for example, something like Tony going with the beauties to vote out Cliff in Kageyan, right? And even when we look at a lot of these instances of people turning on their close allies, the 46 kind of becomes an outlier, because a lot of the time when that happens, it's after a swap. And it's not prior to that, when, you know, people are still on the same tribe. But because of the format of the new era, seemingly resulting in tribes whittling down in numbers a lot quicker than they would in previous iterations of Survivor, it forces this thought process of, hey, yes, I have to persevere and survive here, but like, I can't give someone who's already like really good off socially, someone who's physically and can win challenges, and can't give them another leg up by giving them the comeback story as well.
Yeah, so this is directly referencing Q wanting to turn on Kenzie here and keep Banu in the game. And John, I think your moment is an extremely accurate representation, and I don't want to take the thunder of Gabon.
Okay. So I'm going to get to it in a second, but first off, let's like reflect on the Q Kenzie of it all. How do you feel about this as a move for Q? Like, is Q doing the right thing by wanting to keep Banu as his self-proclaimed Philip Shepherd and going after Kenzie here instead of just going with the easy vote of going for Q?
Banu? It's so hard, because the way he justifies it as like this liability can then turn into an asset, but if your liability is like siphoning information out of your tribe, but the threat would not, I feel like it's almost more beneficial to keep the threat, especially when your number one has them on lock.
But I think that's where Q's concerns come from. I think Q's concerns are how close Tiffany and Kenzie are. I think as much as he's talking about, you know, Kenzie's great socially, she can connect with people really easily, we can't really trust her come a swap or a merge situation, the bigger fear, I think, is that as long as Kenzie's there, Tiffany can never truly be Q's number one.
I mean, this is true, but I feel like Tiffany has never really wavered on Q. She has never been like, oh, Kenzie, Q has been telling me he wants you out. So to me, that feels like Tiffany and Q are actually the number ones, and then Kenzie's in with their group.
I agree. And it's kind of a shame we didn't get to see this tribal council play out to actually see how things would fall, because these dynamics on this tribe are getting really interesting, despite the fact that they're a tribe that we're spending a lot of time with over the first 5.5 hours of this season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I've honestly had enough of this tribe. Give me more green. I need it.
That is fair. We've only gotten about one scene.
I think who's Tim? Aside from the premiere, who's Tim?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the green tribe is just clearly not going to tribal council prior to the merge. I'm pretty sure that's how the edit's reading at this point. We don't want to read too much into the edit, but we would have to know something about them at this point. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, in fact, you know what? Like, the orange tribe also might not go to tribal council, and the only reason we were spending time with them was because of Randon's medevac this episode. Mm-hmm. So it's this interesting question, right? One, we are going to address that in a moment. Don't worry, it's coming. We will talk about Siga and its comparison to other tribes. But first, I do want to talk about like turning on allies in the pre-merge and whether it can be advantageous or not. And the example I want to bring up this week as my outwit is Sugar's decision to turn on Ace in Gabon. This is an interesting situation because it, like I said, like a lot of these type of situations happen post-swap. Even if you think of some of the bigger ones like Jay turning on Mikayla in Millennials vs. Gen X, it's post-swap. It's a different type of game at that point. But when I'm thinking about people who are super tight, Ace and Sugar were literally rise or dies, it seemed like.
Photographer and his model.
Yeah, exactly, right? Like, they were working together in lockstep. They get swapped onto the same tribe. And then along comes Kenny. And Kenny sees this at this opportunity to blindside Ace because Ace is a massive threat. And for those who haven't revisited Gabon recently, Ace was a massive threat. Like, he's likable enough. He's pretty physical. Mm-hmm. Someone who you have to really be wary of once you get to a merge situation. So getting him out pre-merge, especially at this point in the game where it seems like a merge is coming, this was the episode that precedes the fake merge in Gabon.
Yep.
So I understand where Ken's coming from. The problem is the only way to get the numbers in this situation is to get Sugar to vote with him and Crystal. Yep. And luckily things kind of break in a very good way for Ken to do that. In where Maddie has already expressed, you know what, let's just get rid of Sugar. I'm tired of her. Let's get rid of her. He expressed that to Ace, kind of mentioned it to Ken. And as everything progresses, this is an episode where it's a double tribal. Both tribes end up going to tribal council. And in the lead up to tribal council, Ace asks Sugar for the hidden immunity idol. Which makes Sugar far more paranoid about the situation and makes it so she believes what Ken's saying about Ace and Maddie targeting her. And that's the convincing she needs to say, you know what? This is my closest ally, but I think he's a liability to me. I think he is dangerous and someone who I can't fully trust anymore. So I'm going to turn him, vote him out, and you know, I don't want to use confirmation bias here, but Sugar still manages to get to the end of this game. So,
and with zero votes the entire game.
Yeah. Now, to be fair, there was a very good chance Sugar would have gone home at this tribal council, but this is the one where Marcus wins immunity on the log rolling challenge, and after their tribal council, he has to give it to someone on this tribe. So he gives it to Sugar.
Yeah.
Probably knowing that it, like, you know, stirs things up the most and makes it so a bigger threat goes home.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, it's, again, it was this perfect storm for Ken to get Sugar to flip on Ace.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And I think this is one of the epitome moments of turning on your ally because they were those, that ride or die pair. And it's just crazy that it all happened the way it did. And it's good for everyone else in the game to get that ride or die pair broken up. And then that frees Sugar up because the rest of the game, Sugar never really has a home.
Yeah, she becomes a free agent. And yes, it's a dangerous free agent because at this point she's been to Exile Island 5 times. So chances are she has the hidden immunity. I don't know if she doesn't. The only other person who goes is Bob. Right?
No, so, no chance. No one believes that Sugar has the idol.
No, no one at all. But this is such an interesting play because Ace does seem to be the, unlike Kenzie, who is the more social player and someone who you're more worried about the connection she's going to make, Ace feels more like a shield for Sugar. So the decision to go after Ace here and kind of hitch her post to Ken and Crystal, when come the actual merge, Ken and Crystal like are not on her side at all. It's a really risky move, but it goes to show how much the paranoia of the game gets to you.
Yeah. And I think that that note of the paranoia of the game also bleeds into my moment where I'm going into David versus Goliath and the Natalia flip with Alec. So Alec is like paranoid because they are, the Carl is like floating in the balance because he's in exile. And mm-hmm. so Natalia is being sassy around camp and just not great to be around at camp. And he's like, well, I just kind of want to get rid of her. But the, what do I do if I do flip? Because now the Davids will really have the numbers come the next tribal council and I can go home. Alec actually has a pretty good quote. Voting out Natalia is a big risk, but Natalia is really bossy. She's been barking orders at camp and honestly, it's pissing me off. I'm going to have to make a decision. Do I stick with the numbers and get rid of Elizabeth, or do I make a big move? Thing is, if I flip, Carl is going to come back and the Davids will have the numbers. It's exactly like surfing. If you're paddling for a wave and not fully committed, you'll probably just fall. And this could very well blow up my entire game. So I'm going to think about what I'm going to do, and it's going to be something that happens on the spot at Tribal. I find it wild that he compares this move to surfing.
I mean, when you got an analogy, you go for it, especially in like newer seasons of Survivor. We know how much Jeff loves that type of comparison.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think this was just a really brutal blindside that Alec was attached to Kara and Natalia and then decides, no, I'm going to flip because I can't really deal with being around Natalia.
Yeah, the real interesting aspect about this particular situation is that Alec's not just flipping on one of his allies, he's flipping on two of his allies at this point. Like, yeah. Alec, Kara, and Natalia have been connected the entire game up to this point. They've been working mm-hmm. very closely together. And to be swapped to a majority where they, yes, they know that another David is coming to the tribe, but they still have the opportunity to be like, sure, Carl's coming, but we can take out one of Elizabeth or Davy and then still have a majority.
Yeah.
And exactly. Alec throws it all to the wind, also saying, you know what? I can give up the majority here. It's fine. It's mm-hmm. such a wild decision to make. And it's so, again, I think the commonality we have between these moments here is that it's so risky to make these moves. And it's really hard to evaluate them from a logical standpoint as to what is smarter. Because mm-hmm. in this instance, Alex keeping Natalia is good because it, you know, keeps the majority, keeps him safe through this section of the game. But again, it's kind of an instance of, as long as Natalia is here, Kara's never Alex number one.
Yeah, exactly. And Natalia staying around could still provide a rift that could be used by the Davids later. So he was just getting rid of the rift and making his own game move because people think pre-merged moves kind of matter in final tribal council, but not really.
I mean, they do to an extent, right? Especially when they completely change the trajectory of the game. But in this case, and of course, like, the edit's a little harder to, because it's an edited show, we don't get to see everything when it comes down to it all. Mm-hmm. But the edit doesn't quite go far enough to justify Alec's move because they want to keep the mystery of who's going to get voted at.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. And Natalia's convinced it's Elizabeth, and it's not. So it is a great blindside.
It is. It's probably one of the better blindsides in Survivor history. And one of the strongest examples of this idea of hunting someone in the pre-merge because they're going to be a threat later on. I think the other thing when it comes to Natalia and the type of threat she has, yes, she was a bit bossy. She wasn't easy to get along with on this swap drive. But she also has inroads with all of these Goliaths already, right? Like, she was getting along with everyone, mm-hmm. depending on how things broke at Emerge. She's someone who's physically imposing in the way where it's the challenges we tend to see for individual immunity, really. And even if we think about the challenges we saw for individual mm-hmm. immunity in this season, they really benefit someone of Natalia's physique.
Yeah, exactly. So are we ready to move on to our outplay moments and end this suspense for Juan?
Yeah, let's move on to outplay. And the last couple of weeks, we've talked about outplay moments as like the challenge moments. And while we could still technically consider what we're talking about this week as challenge moments, we're taking a little different approach. Because instead of focusing on, you know, some aspect of the challenge, what was the challenge? What was the challenge?
It was the barrel, roll over the barrel, the log,
right.
The dig in for the sandbags, and then the mobile.
Right, exactly. So we could talk about one aspect of those, like something like landing sandbags on targets or something like that. But instead, we're at the point now where we're three episodes in. The same tribe has gone to tribal council all three times, or at least was supposed to go to tribal council all three times. McKenna, let's talk disaster tribes.
Disaster tribes! Yes. So I'm excited to talk disaster tribes because it is just a sight to see. On a rewatch, you know it's going to happen, but you still, like, watching the pre-merge of Palau is so entertaining for me. I could turn it off at the merge. But I know Oolong is losing every immunity challenge, but it's just the dynamics of how to scramble within these shrinking numbers is crazy.
When we have these disaster tribes, people really have to play up their social game and their strategic game a lot more. And we're at a point now where we've seen disaster tribes in half of the New Era seasons, if not more. Yeah, probably four of them, I would say. I mean, we had the Green Tribe in season 41 that mm-hmm. Shannon and Ricard were the only ones who made it to the merge. We had 42 was kind of more even. 43 mm-hmm. was more even. 44, Tika.
Tika
got down to half their tribe size. And they still lost that one after the swap too, right? When the mm-hmm. three of them were still on the same tribe, guess two of them were still on the same tribe.
Yeah.
They still lost again. And then last season, obviously, we had Lulu. So this is kind of a common occurrence now, are these disaster tribes, but it's interesting to look at them and see why they're disaster tribes. So yeah. McKenna, you mentioned Oolong already. Does Oolong count as a disaster tribe? Yes, they didn't win any immunity challenges in the pre-merge, but they still won
a decent amount of rewards. So we're not counting Oolong, but we are going, for me, since I just watched Philippines, we are going Matt Singh. So no, that is not Samoa Russell Swan on the thumbnail. That is Philippines Russell Swan. This Matt Singh in Philippines just explodes. And I think Zane Knight sets the tone when he's like, I'm going to go home, vote me out. And then turns around and is like, but don't actually. Like this whole thing with Zane, I think, sets the tone, because then you have Angie with the cookies and the cuddling that had to leave. Then, you know, Roxy wasn't pulling her as much of her weight in challenges. And the main reason Russell Swan is still here is because he has some form of muscle mass.
Yeah. I mean, he appears physically strong, but if you remember the third and fourth immunity challenge in this season, Russell Swan is not pulling his weight.
Yeah. So if you want to hear us dive a little bit deeper into Matt Singh, we'll still talk a little bit about it. But if you want to hear us dive a little bit deeper into Matt Singh, that is our episode for the Patreon. So that should be live now or soon or whatever. So we are watching Philippines episode 4, Create a Little Chaos. It is the Russell Swan boot. And it actually has a lot of comparisons to this episode of 46, aside from being the disaster tribe.
Yeah, absolutely. I kind of want to go a different approach. I want to approach a tribe that is a disaster. Like, there are a few we could choose. We could choose Luzon. Three of them make it pretty deep still in Cagayan. We could take Manu from Edge of Extinction. That was a pretty bad tribe that couldn't really win at all either. But I think where I really want to go with this, I want to go to Foa Foa in Samoa. There's Natalie White from Foa Foa. And that's because I really want to focus on the differences in these disaster tribes. I want to look at these tribes and kind of dissect why they're disaster tribes. So let's start with 46. Let's start with our Siga tribe. Why do they keep losing, McKenna?
Yanu keeps losing.
Yanu. Yeah.
So I believe that Yanu keeps losing because they are just not all, they're all cogs in the machine, but some of their teeth aren't catching. They're grinding and grating. Yeah. So they're not synchronized in these challenges. This last one, they were the closest to, because they did say, like, I'm tired, I'm stepping out, changed, and they changed throwers. Nobody was yelling. It was all very calm. So I feel like this was their best challenge that they have done, obviously, because they were so close to winning. Mm-hmm. But I think it's just they want the machine to run, and so they're trying to work it, but it's just not making the right sound.
Yeah, I think, like, sometimes when you have these starting tribes, it's just a matter of the composition of them. And I know, like, production and Survivor has been on record kind of saying since in the last few seasons, I think it's the last 10 seasons or so, they've really tried at balancing the tribe strengths out more.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't seem to be coming to fruition, really. Like, it seems like they're very imbalanced still. But I don't know how you resolve it, right? If we look at, I think one of the best examples of, like, tribal balance that we ever saw in Survivor and how it doesn't really work is China.
All the average people and then the big and the littles.
Yeah. And it's just a weird way of balancing it, especially when you're not just, like, testing them on their aptitude and stuff like that. Like, you're not testing them on their physical capabilities. You're not, like, yes, I mean, obviously there's, like, physical things they need to do as part mm-hmm. of the audition process, but you aren't actually testing them, especially in a situation that's similar to Survivor. That, I think, is the big asterisk mm-hmm. on anything. You can do physical tests with these people during the audition process, but if they haven't eaten for 3 days, they're going to perform completely differently than they mm-hmm. do in those situations.
Yeah. I think I completely lost my thought. John, you were talking too much and I lost my thought. Keep picking.
Well, I'm going to go.
It'll bring my memory back to
Yanu here. I don't think there is any specific person who's kind of bringing this tribe down. I remember now. Okay, good.
You were talking about even tribes. I'm going to bring it up. South Pacific is one of the most even seasons because they go every other losing.
Right.
And, like, if they casted something similar to South Pacific in physicality, then you might see a more even dynamic. But I think the three tribes brings out that availability for demolition.
I think it's harder to balance three tribes than it is two tribes.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to say, okay, here's our two strong guys, let's sit them on two separate tribes. Here's our two strong women, let's put them on separate tribes. When you get three, now you have to find three people of kind of equal athleticism or strengths in challenges in general. Like, it could be puzzle strength and stuff like that too.
Yeah. Like Jonathan.
Yeah.
Like, right? You have to try and find two guys that meet this one, but then Jonathan's doing this, the task of one guy, and the other tribes are two guys doing the task of just the one guy's task. So it's like, it's hard to balance it when it is such small numbers with six on each tribe.
And I think on paper, Yanu probably should be one of the stronger tribes here.
Should it, though?
Well, Q's what? A Division A athlete?
True. Or
was a Division A athlete. Bon is no slouch. Mm-hmm. And then both, like, Tiffany's probably one of the strongest women out there.
True.
Right?
I think Jess's head not being fully in the game hurt them. And Kenzie is so little. And that really impacts, like, we were talking about China. Courtney's so little. Todd is so little. It does really impact the game. And when you can't sit these people out, like, they could sit out Liz and Mariah. Maybe they're more, like, smaller people, or they're less confident people. So they couldn't sit out Jess. They couldn't sit out Kenzie.
Yeah, that's very true too. And sometimes I think with Survivor, we see the ball gets rolling because of the sit outs, right? When a tribe has the opportunity to sit people, and I think that's also part of the reason why production changed the rule last season when it came to sit outs, and it's not every cycle now that you can sit.
Well, because we don't really have rewards anymore.
Exactly. Like, it made sense from a logical perspective that way, but because of that, we see Yanu's just not clicking. That's really what it comes down to. And I think that's very similar to Matt Singh. Matt Singh, on paper, had the two strongest guys out there in Philippines.
Yeah, for
sure. And Denise is probably the strongest woman on that season.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like RC wasn't in the individual game enough for me to, like, maybe evaluate
it. Sure.
But... yeah, I'd say Denise is for sure up there for strongest women. I love a disaster tribe, and even though it can be predictable, I think it still can be fun to watch. Or, so, you know, there are times where it's very much not fun, and they're really sad, but give me Oolong any day.
So let's take it back to Matt Singh here. Now that we've kind of talked
about... You mean the episode that we're doing for the Patreon?
Yes, that one.
Okay.
Become a patron, please. Now that we've talked about Yanu and kind of why they aren't winning, why is Matt Singh the epitome of a disaster tribe? Like, when we talk about...
Two words, John. Two words. Russell Swan.
Okay, internet. Okay. I'm going to ask you to elaborate on that, because Matt Singh is Matt Singh's just, like, the epitome of a tribe that loses, because they literally... Oolong should have been that epitome, but because they won reward challenges, people remember that they, like, actually had strength. Matt Singh literally didn't win a challenge.
Okay. Russell Swan, that is why. Because he's like, I can't do puzzles, so someone else is doing puzzles. And Angie was like, I also, you know, I can't really do puzzles, but you're doing the puzzle because I can't do the puzzle. So he's still dictating where people need to be, where... If you had someone who might be strong on this puzzle, even one person, the other person can hand pieces, something to that effect. So I just don't think they were putting the right people in the right spots, because Russell was dictating where he wanted to be, and that was not necessarily in the right spot for him either. He wants to put the image of this brute strength guy, but I think he has popcorn muscles.
Yes.
You can see the six pack, but what's it doing? Absolutely nothing.
I agree. And I think that's really epitomized in the third immunity challenge of the season, where he can't even get out of the water. Right? Like, he has that strength and he can't even lift himself out of the water. One of the big things, I think, with Matt Singh is... And I think you're right. I do think Russell is a big reason why they keep losing. And I think it's because Russell has this overconfidence. It's really exemplified later on in the episode we talked about on the Patreon. Because...
Please become a patron.
Because Russell talks about this idea, like, if I'm doing my best, I should be able to win. Like, I should be winning if I'm doing my best. And it's that idea that he is the ideal leader. He is the type of person that everyone else.
But he doesn't want to be the leader. He comes out right off the bat. I'm not the leader. I'm not the chief. I'm not anything. But he still takes on that role because he still views himself as that. And I think put Jonathan Penner or Redacted on that tribe wins. It's the time.
I think so. Like I think it's the mentality Russell took into those challenges of, no, we're going to win. Because he felt he deserved to win and didn't actually fight for the win is what it kind of feels like to me.
He didn't have the merit to deserve the win. So let's move on to our outlast.
Let's talk Foa first.
We've talked Foa.
No, we did not actually. But the reason why Foa is this disaster is also Russell, but it's the other Russell. It's Russell. This is someone who's just, I mean, we get to see a lot of the reason why Foa sucks because, and like, you know, there are some great characters on Foa, not the one.
Betsy?
Yeah, absolutely.
Marisa?
No.
Ben Browning?
No. No.
Mike Barassi?
I'm literally talking about Natalie White. Okay, I get it.
Literally naming everyone not in the foe of them before.
Yes. Actually, Mike Barassi, taken away from the game too early. I mean, dude practically suffered a heart attack on the season, so like, great medical evac. It had to happen. But the point is, Russell created so much animosity in this tribe, they could never get on the same page. Even though, and I mean, granted, you look at the other tribe, I think they're physically stronger. I think. And they were just in a better mood the entire time. But Russell's sabotaging. Because
they had no one burning socks and dumping out water.
Exactly. And that's what it really comes down to, is Russell went so hard in this pre-merge that it was just detrimental to Foa. They couldn't catch a break. And because of that, it just kept the ball rolling.
And he needed to have his dumb girl alliance. And anybody who showed some form of brain cell, he knocked out. And so that was someone or who he thought showed brain cells, because obviously Natalie White, very intelligent. But he just like was knocking out people that could be strong for his tribe. I did mention Betsy for a reason, because I think she was a cop. She has obviously like some physical ability. So I think she could have actually been an asset to the tribe trying to win a challenge.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, when you look at the Foa 4, they don't keep the weakest people on the tribe, right? It's not like there are just a bunch of people who can't win at challenges. Yes, there are, because they didn't win challenges. But when you look at, like, you had Mick, you had Jason, you had Natalie, and you had Russell. That's who this tribe ends up being in the end. It's just not clicking. And it's because of this paranoia. It's because Russell is making everyone...
You're with me or against me.
Exactly. And it's because this is Russell's tribe and not a tribe altogether. It's the exact same thing we were talking about with Matt Singh, right? Where one person is the tribe and it's going to dictate how well the tribe can do.
Yeah, exactly.
Now we can move on to our outlast.
All right, outlast. This is actually going to be my favorite portion of this episode. Typically, it is outplay, and I did enjoy our outplay, but I love this outlast a little bit more. And we are talking provider roles, because we had a whole kind of montage scene with Hunter, and I just loved that until it got to Venus destroying Hunter, and I was like, oh, can't we relish in this camp life moment before we get into game? And I loved this moment with Hunter. I'm making a mattress. I'm going out spear fishing. I'm opening coconuts, this, that, and the other thing. I really enjoyed watching this segment.
Yeah, it's an interesting segment because we haven't really gotten it in the new era.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think off the top of my head, and someone please correct me if I'm wrong. I can't think of a moment where
we did talk about fishing at one point, but it was brief. It wasn't like a super long. We were like, oh wow, they're fishing. And then we talked about some fishing moments. But nothing to like this provider extent where Hunter was talking about using it as a strategy, which leads into my one that I stole from John. I was like, I don't care. I am doing this example. And obviously, the Borneo lover that I am, I'm taking Richard Hatch as my provider moment. I think anyone who will go to the lengths of letting a shark bite him and bite him back and then him bite the shark back is a pretty good provider. He also does use it the entire game of Borneo as his strategy, saying, keep me in. I'm giving you fish. I'm the only one that is filling your bellies.
Yeah, and this strategy works so much better in the earlier seasons of Survivor. Now, granted, some of those seasons, it was hard to be a provider. Obviously, in the Outback, you had to hunt boar if you really wanted to be a provider. Africa, you couldn't be a provider because everything that you went out to get would probably kill you. And some seasons, you just can't really be a provider because you're not in a place where you can fish like this.
Yeah.
But Borneo was the perfect situation where Hatch could, for some reason, Hatch was really good with a Hawaiian sling. And he just used that to his advantage to make it so that everyone wanted to keep him around, despite the fact he's the one scheming. He's the one behind the scenes kind of driving all strategy on that season. He knew that if he was getting food for people, like, they would be happy. You placate, people who are not hungry are easier to placate.
Mm-hmm.
And they just don't want to deal with that at all.
Yeah, I love Borneo for what it is. This time capsule of a season where you do see people just hanging out and living on an island, and Hatch is like, I caught 3 stingrays today, and everyone's like, oh yay, and then we get, you know, a shot of them cooking the eel, and it gets all rubbery, and Hatch is like, I told you not to cook this for that long, and like, now all of my work has gone to waste. These calories that I've burnt for you guys to try and fuel you, you know, and we get that moment in a few of the earlier seasons, but I just feel like when you hear provider role, you hear Hatch, because that was his strategy, his shield, as what Hunter is using for his shield as well.
And that's the bigger thing. And I'm surprised we haven't had the conversation that Hunter brought up in this episode of 46, of that idea of using the provider role as a way to keep you in. Especially, yes, okay, it's a shorter season, so maybe like that doesn't matter as much anymore. But they aren't getting supplies at the beginning of the season anymore.
Right? Yeah.
It's not like they have a big bag of rice that they can eat small portions of every single day. Mm-hmm. So to be that provider is kind of a bigger deal. And especially Hunter, who's using it as a way to hide his intelligence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's like, I'm big man, I fish, I make bed.
Yeah, exactly. It's really clever the way he's approaching this typical role that we haven't seen on Survivor for a long time, because we've been focused more on the strategy side in the edit.
Yeah, exactly. And I think he also, like, an honorable mention for us is Wendell, because he is making like the bed and the furniture, because that was a thing that Wendell did for everyone to try and make them feel comfortable at camp. And so that was another form of that provider role that Wendell filled.
See, the one issue I have with the Wendell comparison is that building furniture is like a one-time thing. Right?
That's true.
It's a continual thing. And Juan brings up, like, we had Ryan in 43, Jonathan in 42, and Nasir in 41. They didn't phrase themselves the same way Hunter did in this situation.
Yeah, they didn't like use it as like their main strategy for the game to like mask themselves of playing a different strategy.
Yeah. So the example I want to bring up is probably someone else. It's not Rupert. I know Rupert's probably where a lot of people go when they start thinking provider, because Rupert kind of tried to do the hatch thing. They're like, I'm going to be the provider. I'm going to make it so that people want to keep me along. It didn't work. Rupert wasn't game savvy enough to pull off what Hatch did. And my example, I don't think really started this as a major strategy in this game. And it was more he was just doing it because he enjoyed doing it. But
Juan beat you to the punch.
Juan beat me to the punch. I'm Juan. You got to give me a chance to get the words out of my mouth. But specifically, I think Ozzy does this really well, especially in South Pacific, where he does it on Redemption Island as a way to get jury votes. It's a different type of strategy for the provider. But because Ozzy goes to Redemption Island so early in South Pacific, he can literally just keep everyone fed there the entire time. People at Redemption Island probably are eating better than people on the main beaches in that season.
I mean, Ozzy says it himself. He's like, this is the best I've ever felt, the best I've ever eaten. He constantly is getting new people, so it's new faces that he sends to the jury, and he's not stuck with the same people over and over. So I think this is like Ozzy's ideal strategy. Aside from Cook Islands, where, you know, he makes it to the end, he'll never make it to the end because of who he is and who he portrayed himself as in Cook Islands, the super athletic provider. Like, that is a death sentence pretty much nowadays.
Yeah, especially when you put in the fact that he's like a really chill guy for the most part, so it's easy to get along with him
until you spark.
Yeah, until you like turn him on. But we didn't see that until we got later on. Not what I meant.
Go to his OnlyFans for that.
No, yeah. Not what the content we are talking about here. But Ozzy, but when Ozzy gets to the point where he has to be real game savvy, he can be. But again, we don't really see that until his later seasons, right? Until he's been bamboozled and kind of seen
bamboozled, you say?
Hatch? Yes, I made the Hatch reference, okay? But because Ozzy in Cook Islands is feeding people. Like, he is using this provider strategy as well. But it isn't as necessary the further into that game he gets. Because the further into the game he gets, there are other people who can clearly do it as well. It's not like the Hatch situation in Borneo, where Hatch was the only one who could seem to do it. Hatch was so efficient at it, we saw other people literally not be able to do it.
Yeah, I mean, heck, let's bring up Super Bowl.
I know you love bringing up the Super Bowl.
Yeah, and I mean, we see also in All-Stars, Hatch is voted out here, but we have Rupert, and Rupert's like, I'm going to be the provider, and then Boston Rob goes and gets as many or more fish. Big Tom also goes out and catches a few fish. Like, there are other people that are able to do things, but when you are the pioneer basically of this strategy, you are the only one.
And I think like how Ozzy compares to Hatch, obviously not as devious, not as strategic as Hatch, but I think Ozzy does kind of get the benefit of the doubt here when it comes to the provider role, because not only is he fishing and is just phenomenal in the water, he's also like climbing trees and getting like fruit and stuff, right? But when you look at the way he's approaching the game, it's not to hide his intelligence the way Hunter is. And that's, I think, the big difference. But when we see it in South Pacific, there's clearly a strategic mind going into how he is providing on Redemption Island.
Yeah, exactly. Great comparisons.
Thanks. Yes. You as well.
Yeah, I love going back to those nostalgia feels. Obviously, I mentioned this last week, we love when we can reference old school Survivor because we rewind the current season of Survivor because we miss the old nostalgic moments. So to be able to go back to something like a provider role rather than just they did this challenge is really unique.
Yeah.
And I'm really glad that they had that portion in the episode.
Yeah, I mean, obviously they're just trying to fill 90 minutes and they didn't quite have the material to do so. But I'm glad we're getting that because sometimes I feel despite what Banu was saying this episode about like not being there for $1 million, being there for $1 million hearts and everything, sometimes we miss the adventure of Survivor in the new era. Mm-hmm. And the fact that like these are people who are just going out of their way and learning and experiencing, having this life experience. And we don't get it sometimes, but when we have those moments, like with Hunter this week, it just feels like old school Survivor again.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Love me some old school Survivor.
Yeah.
John, I think unless you have anything else for these providers, we can head into what the heck is going on this week.
Well, that's a great question because we have lots going on this week. Obviously, if you didn't catch the recap after Wednesday's episode, go check that out. Blake joins Phil again to break that down. Yesterday, Philip McKenna broke down the premiere of The Amazing Race.
I am so excited. The Amazing Race is back. And I get to walk Phil through the race. He is a casual, if any of you are still around from the Amazing Casuals. And Celestina and I are still podcasting on The Amazing Race, but it's still over on the Patreon. So that'll be your Saturday show. Over there, we are calling it Root Info, and we'll be ripping Blake and Phil's Digging Deeper off and putting it for The Amazing Race. So we'll be focusing on specific Amazing Race events. So this time we're talking about how non-elimination legs impact the game, because whether having them or not having them.
Absolutely. And we have a full week slated ahead of here. Sunday, make sure to catch the Predictions and Power Rankings with Jake O'Kane from season 45. That should be a really good one. If not Jake just for thing. Phil kind of gushing over Jake, because we know how much Phil loved Jake by the end of that season.
I mean, I'm jealous I'm not on that podcast.
I am too. I 100% am. Monday, Phil and I are going to be breaking down the Letterboxd Top 16 in our new March Madness bracket for the Cinema Specialist. This is going to be a really interesting conversation. We're not talking about what the best movie is. We are talking about which of these movies that are the 16 most popular movies on Letterboxd should be the most popular movie. It'll be a really interesting conversation, so make sure to check that out. Tuesday, Phil and Will are going to be breaking down the latest episode of Deal or No Deal Island. Wednesday, of course, it's going to be the episode 4 recap. Thursday, McKenna and Phil are going to be back with The Amazing Race. And then, of course, next Friday, you get us again for the rewind. And if that isn't enough for you,
there's just so much on the Patreon. Follow us on Instagram. We post all of these schedules over on the Instagram because there's a lot to keep track of over there.
There is, but think about becoming a patron. If you are liking this content and you want more, there is so much available at all different tier levels. The $5 tier, the $10 tier, and the $20 tier. Obviously, the $20 tier is going to get the most content. So please, if you're interested, hit up that link right below me and check it out. Other than that, make sure you like and subscribe. It really does help the channel out quite a lot. And we'll see you next week.
Goodbye, everyone!